I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest in a current issue of the Republic, the New Republic, writes this: recent political decisions have rejected sacrifice in favor of what's in it for me approach, and in the process polarized the nation. To make matters worse, our leaders and opinion makers have convinced too many of us conveniently that our self-interest is also in the interest of the greater good, implying that no compromise or shared sacrifice is ever needed. And he goes on to give some examples. The article is titled, "Why Are the Children of the Greatest Generation So Selfish?" And our guest is co-author of that piece, Matthew Paull. Matthew was Senior Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of McDonald's Corporation until he retired from that position in 2008. He was responsible for all financial matters of the company and had direct reporting responsibilities for accounting, facilities and systems, information services, and more. Prior to joining McDonald's, he was a partner at Ernst & Young, where he managed a variety of financial practices during his 18-year career there. He has served as a board member of the Loyola Ronald McDonald House and an advisory council member for the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. He serves on a number of boards and is our guest this hour. What do you think? Are the children of the greatest generation selfish? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Matthew.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Thanks
for having me on your show.
Yeah, thanks very much for being with us. So you're a member of that baby boom generation. Have you personally had to fight selfishness or not?
I certainly have personally had to fight selfishness. But, you know, you get to a certain age, and I'm now 60, and you step back and you think about all the wonderful things our country has done for me and many of my friends. And you begin to wonder how we could degenerate into the political dysfunction we currently have, where it seems like in earlier times our leaders could call on us to pull together and sacrifice to make life better for our children, and today's leaders don't seem to be willing or able to do that. Instead, they try to play one group against the other, and it's very disturbing.
You mentioned Tom Brokaw in his book, The Greatest Generation, and I think about that was my father's generation and probably your father's generation and mother's generation, that there was something that united the whole country at that time, and that was a major war, a war that was fighting huge evil. Do you think that we haven't had anything this generation that unifies us in the same way?
I think our parents' generation, your parents and my parents, lived through the Great Depression, World War II, Hitler and all the tyrannical rulers that were threatening us definitely united us. And it created, what we refer to in the article as a majority consensus. The country united behind our leaders because it was easy to see who the enemy was. It wasn't an internal enemy. It was an obvious external enemy. And the problem today, one of the problems, is we don't have quite as obvious an external enemy. And so our political leaders seem to be trying to play, one group off against the other, whether it's the rich against the middle class or the middle class against the rich. And I spent 35 years in business. One of the things I learned is that doesn't get you anywhere. I spent a lot of time at McDonald's Corporation, a wonderful company. One of the things I learned is McDonald's is very dependent on its franchisees who own most of the restaurants in the United States. And there was a time in the 90s and the early 2000s when the company would fight with the franchisees about who gets the biggest piece of the pie. And when that happened, we stopped growing the pie.
Hmm.
When we stopped fighting among ourselves and began trying to do a better job serving customers and focusing our efforts on being better than our competitors, we started growing the pie again. You know, my fear and my concern is that in our country now, we are arguing about how to divide the pie, and as a result, we're not growing the pie.
And there seem to be a lot of people, maybe that helps answer the question that I've had recently, and that's this social responsibility. I can remember working in the press, serving on an editorial board of a station in Milwaukee years ago, where we would highlight and look at those companies that had a sense of social responsibility. We seem to be living in an age where everybody's sort of out for, what can I get for myself? I'm going to sit on lots of money because I'm going to make more money if I acquire another company, instead of looking at perhaps hiring people so that everybody can have a little bit of a better life. There isn't much of that. Let's see what we can do to help everybody have a decent life feeling anymore.
Well, I'm going to politely disagree with you. I believe in roles and responsibilities, and companies, for the most part, I believe, are doing a better job today with social responsibility than they used to. It doesn't mean that they're hiring people to create more jobs. It does mean that when they make money, they're trying to do a better job of helping communities. When you look at corporate giving and corporate sponsorship of various forms of philanthropy compared to 30 or 40 years ago, I believe we'd see that it's way up. Now, a company's primary job, this may not be a popular notion with all of your listeners, but the company's job is to make money for its stakeholders, primarily its shareholders, but certainly also its employees. And it can only give back to the community, which is something McDonald's believed in a very big way. It can only give back to the community if it makes enough money to do so. So I don't want to confuse the role of the company with the role of government and the role of private individuals. I believe that most companies in the United States are here to make money for shareholders, and if they do good in the community, I think that helps it become easier to do good for shareholders.
What about, though, all that's happened, Matthew, in this generation that has moved a lot of those companies to places that are not in the United States, that there's a whole different way that the world operates and that finance operates and export and import? We're looking at something that's very different than our parents' generation. Things aren't being done here. People are not being hired here. They're elsewhere.
I absolutely agree with you. We have a tremendous problem. When you look at the trends that are affecting where good middle-class jobs are being created, it's an ugly picture for the United States right now. So we have a number of things at work. It starts with globalization and free trade. There's no doubt in my mind that globalization and free trade make for a bigger pie in the United States. But when you look at how that pie gets divided, it becomes very uneven.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a company that needs to manufacture something, you're going to try to do it where you can do it as inexpensively as possible. And when you're dealing with foreign competition that can take advantage of much cheaper wage rates, foreign competition that possibly has less onerous regulations affecting how they produce, there is an incentive, certainly, to send your manufacturing to other countries where it can be done much more cheaply. You add to that the effect of technology over the last two decades. It's clearly eroding the number of workers it takes to do any given job. And companies, I would say especially large ones, have figured out how to make money with fewer workers. And that does not bode well for our middle class. So we had kind of a quid pro quo in this country where the middle class supported free enterprise because they had a stake in free enterprise. They knew that there was a chance to have an improving lifestyle, some upward mobility, certainly equal opportunity, and some form of safety net. And what's happening now is, because of globalization, because of the factors we talk about, the pie in the U.S. over the last two decades has grown, but so has income disparity, and the middle class is kind of taking it in the shorts right now, and they're asking themselves, and I certainly understand why, what's in it for me do I have a stake in our economic system? And if I don't, I might elect political leaders who will make that economic system work better for me. And that then threatens some of the foundations of free enterprise. Mm.
Let's talk about wars for a moment. You in the article talk about the fact that we're fighting three wars with a volunteer army while refusing to pay for them, passing the cost of financing the wars to the next generation. A couple questions. Do you think there's a need for any of those wars or all of those wars? And would you do away with a volunteer army and reinstitute some kind of draft?
Well, that's a tough question. I'm certainly not an expert about whether or not we should be fighting the wars. I generally support what our president has been doing, our current president. What I did not like about the wars is the way we chose to finance them, which is we said, we're going to fight the war and we're going to rely on volunteers, which generally means people from the lower and middle classes are more likely to be in a volunteer army. So it's not our whole society that's fighting the war. It's probably more supported by the sons and daughters of our middle and lower classes. But I especially didn't like that we passed a tax cut at the time we decided to launch a war. To me, the country should have felt the sacrifice of going to war, the whole country, and instead we passed a tax cut, which frankly benefited people like me a lot more than other people. I thought it just wasn't the right thing to do, and it wasn't the right message to send. We were sort of saying to ourselves, we can do whatever we want. We can have it all. We don't have to pay for it. We'll let our children and our children's children pay for it.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of tax code do you think we need, Matthew?
You know, in the first place, the way our I practiced international tax for 18 years, so I have a strong opinion about this. The problem with our tax law is this. It has to do with campaign funding. People who run for office need a lot of money to do so. One of the ways you raise funds, if you're a politician, is you announce that you're going to change our tax law and you're going to hold hearings on what changes should take place. And when a politician makes that announcement, the money starts pouring in. And so I believe that we need to simplify our tax law. We do not want the tax law picking winners and losers and favoring certain industries. But our politicians, because they need money to run for office, will always make for more complex tax law. Even if we pass simplification, it will be only a matter of years before they start reintroducing complexity because that's the way they raise funds. So I believe we could have a lower tax rate for everybody if we simplified and we broadened the base. I personally think I'm in a higher bracket that I could afford to pay a little bit more. I didn't need the Bush tax cut. I do not believe that lowering taxes is the solution to every problem. And I believe that the income disparity that we've created in this country will actually ultimately threaten free enterprise. If I could just talk about Steve Forbes for a second.
Sure.
I've seen Steve Forbes interviewed over a period of 10 years. And his solution to almost every problem is to lower taxes on the rich. His point is that that creates an incentive to innovate, and that will lead to more jobs. And as an economic theorist, he's absolutely right. The problem with his argument is that it will leave the middle class further and further behind. And if our great middle class that does all the hard work in this country doesn't have a stake in the system, they will start electing politicians who will erode free enterprise as we know it.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. We have a lot of other territory to cover. He talks in the piece about an energy problem, that the supply and demand problem threatening our environment and our security, and yet nobody is asking us to sacrifice to solve the issue. We will certainly explore that and more with Matthew Paul, co-author of a piece in The New Republic, Why Are the Children of the Greatest Generation So Selfish? Our phone number, our lines are filled, but eventually there will be a place for you, 1-800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, Calvin Trillin will be joining us. I think the last time we had him as a guest was right after Studs Terkel died, and he gave moving words about Studs' life. Calvin has a new book, and it's just wonderful. It's Quite Enough of Calvin Trillin. It's a collection of 40 years of his writing for The New Yorker and also for The Nation. I think one of the things that I like a lot of things about Calvin, he's a great writer, but he's just a down-to-earth, wonderful observer of human interaction. And he is from the Midwest, where he had a thoroughly happy childhood. Actually, he says he's from Kansas City. He's found that a lot of people say they're from Kansas City when they aren't, just for the prestige. He makes me laugh. Calvin Trillin tomorrow during this time period. Matthew Paul is with us now. We have a ton of phone calls, and let's go to Hans in Shorewood first. Hi, Hans.
Hey, hello. How are you doing today?
Fine. How are you?
Good. Okay, my first thing is why this generation is so selfish. Is now you got to remember these kids grew up from their parents' depression and World War II, and they sacrificed a lot. Okay, and they don't want to lose what they have, and that's why I think they're holding on to a lot. And number two, I wish people would read the book called Player Piano by Kurt Vonnegut Jr. Have you ever heard of it?
Yes.
Okay, how the classes will be one side on one track and the other side on the other track, and that's pretty much where this society is going, where things are being automated. Like you said, Mark said, there isn't enough jobs, and now these wealthy people are going to have to subsidize to keep people like myself. My wife's on SSI. She's on kidney dialysis and amputee.
Oh.
We don't make any money, and this is what's happening to this country. Nobody is trying to help anybody, and they're all keeping the money.
Matthew.
Well, I'm sympathetic to what Hans described. There's a lot of that going on. I think if you looked at the papers today, the Wall Street Journal had a report about a median income in the United States, and it's currently for a household at the same level it was in 96. So our middle class is making no progress. And if you look at males in the household, their real income is less than it was in 1978. So a male working full-time on a real income basis is making less than he did in 1978. And so it is a threat to what many of us love about this country, and hopefully we're going to wake up before it's too late. One of the concerns I have is that politicians who try to stick to the middle ground, who understand that free enterprise is a wonderful system, we just have to make it work better for more people, politicians who have a middle-of-the-road message like Evan Bay get chased out of their political parties. So unless you're, on the far left or the far right, increasingly there's no place for you today in our politics, and that is very unfortunate. In the old days, people could reach compromises for the greater good. Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan could get in a room and work out a deal. Even Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton could get in a room and work out a deal for the greater good. But because of the dysfunctionality of our politics right now, anybody who proposes a solution that's in the middle somewhere gets shouted down. It's very unfortunate.
Thank you, Hans, for the call. Ron is next in Brooking Grove. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. I was born in Kansas City.
Oh, you were? Hello? Oh, Ron, I'm sorry. He was born in Kansas City. That's all we heard. I'm sure there's more to that. Call back tomorrow and get Calvin
Barbecue.
Calvin, a call tomorrow. Carl in Fox Lake. Hi.
Oh, hello?
Hi, Carl.
Oh, yes. I think that the person most responsible for this problem is St. Ronald Reagan, who we still name bridges after. He taught the philosophy that you should think only of yourself, only he raised self-interest practically to a religion. He said that greed is good. You never need to sacrifice. Taxes are a form of theft. He was truly a cheerleader for our worst instincts, and that's been promulgated for 30 years now, especially by George W. Bush. And I think it's that 30 years of Reaganism that is really most responsible for the problems that we have today, where nobody's willing to sacrifice. we start wars and we cut taxes at the same time and so on. I think it's Reaganism that is the problem.
Matthew, you agree?
Well, you know, I had some issues with President Reagan. I never voted for him. But I think it goes way beyond him. Let's just talk about our energy problem for a second. I think most rational people would agree we have a huge problem. It's not just a threat to our environment, but our national security. The higher oil prices go, the more money goes into the pockets of our enemies. And yet, what do we choose to do about it? Our politicians, if you got them in a room and talked to them privately, would all agree that we need to wean America from our dependence on gasoline. And a way to do that would be to put some kind of a tax on gasoline, and yet politically, it would be very unpopular. Nobody wants to ask us to do it. It is a threat to our national security and our environment. And if it were Hitler who was coming at us, and the problem were that immediate, we would see it and we would act on it. Because this isn't a problem that's going to happen overnight, it's been happening over time, nobody sees the need to deal with it, and our politicians are too fearful to ask us to sacrifice. You know, I personally think we should be driving less because that's helping the people who hate us. And yet, no politician who's out there has had the guts to suggest that we ought to wean ourselves from gasoline. And so I think it goes way beyond Reagan. You know, I'll criticize some of the leaders on the left as well. You look at Social Security, it's a wonderful program. We need to be sure it's around for a very long time. There are some very easy fixes we could do to Social Security, but people like Nancy Pelosi say, no, you can't touch it. First of all, I think we should be means testing Social Security. Secondly, we should be slightly raising the age at which you qualify for benefits. And third, we need to index it to real inflation, not to the wage inflation they have it indexed to today. If you made those three fixes, it would be around forever. But there are certain politicians on the left who say you can't touch anything about it. Why should I? I'm very comfortable financially. Why should I get any Social Security? Just because I paid into the system doesn't mean I should be taking out. So, yeah, I think it goes way beyond Ronald Reagan. I think our leaders are focused on getting reelected. In corporate America, there was a big controversy a decade or two ago about alignment of interests. Politicians were concerned that managements of companies didn't have interests that were aligned with shareholders. So they made certain that we're paid only if the company performs. That was generally a good thing. Our politicians today are not aligned with the voters. The politicians' goal is to keep their party in power and to get reelected. Their goal is not to make life better for Americans. And I think we need some kind of realignment of their goals. I'd like to see their pensions tied to our country's prosperity. Then I think they begin to act in our self-interest instead of their self-interest.
I was surprised to learn earlier this week, and I wonder how you capture and move on with a vision when you talk about the energy situation. We've heard about creation of green jobs and this being a whole industry that could flourish in the United States. Monday I learned that four solar companies in this country shut down, which goes against what our common wisdom is, that we're starting to do startup businesses here. And the country that's really making this happen is China. Why is it China and not the United States?
Well, you know, I'll give you my view of this. I'm not saying I'm an expert. China practices a form of free enterprise that in many ways is more powerful than what we're doing here in the United States. In the U.S., you know, we have free enterprise along with political democracy. And sometimes the political democracy gets in the way of free enterprise. In China, that doesn't happen. When the Chinese government wants something to happen, it happens. In the United States, if you had a company, a private interest, that wanted to invest in solar energy, it would take many, many billions of dollars and a long period of time. For a company, a private company, to want to do that, they have to believe that energy prices will be very high for a long period of time. So there are companies out there who invested in technologies that would be alternatives to oil. The problem is that every time oil prices go back down, those companies get wiped out. So oil prices, you know, gasoline prices where I buy gas are $4 a gallon today. and that seems high. And if companies knew that the price would always be that high, they would have an incentive to invest a lot of money to find alternatives. One of our problems is there is always the risk that prices will go back down. And so why would any private enterprise spend billions of dollars and take, you know, 10 years to come up with alternatives when the stated goal of a lot of our politicians is to keep gas prices as low as possible? They say that because they want to get elected. They don't say that because they think that is in our country's long-term best interest.
Thanks for the call, Carl. Christine in Madison, hi.
Hi. I am in my late 60s and want to say that I think that some of this lack of consideration for the common good goes back to the 60s, where I remember in Berkeley having great arguments with people about how they would say, oh, everybody has the right to do their own thing. And you can be walking down the street, and so somebody comes and they push you off the street because of their actions, and it'd be, well, they have the right to do that. And you hear on our, and I think that that's perpetrated. I'm kind of appalled by all these advertisements that say you have the right to feel good about yourself, you have the right to beautiful hair, you have, we're talking about having rights for all kinds of things. And yet we're not talking about the common good, that if we pay our taxes, that supports the infrastructure of our country. When with the thing in Wisconsin, we had people saying, let's take away benefits of public employees because we don't have them, rather than thinking, how can we all have the same benefits? And so we've really lost the sense of caring about the common good. People who don't want to pay taxes for schools because they don't have kids in schools right now, but their kids went through the schools. It's such a lack of common good, and so that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Thanks, Christine.
I agree with a lot of what Christine said, that there's very few political leaders trying to appeal to the common good. They don't even talk about it. They try to convince us that our self-interest will lead to the common good, but they're really trying to appeal to our self-interest. And, you know, politicians on both sides turn me off when they exercise class warfare. There was a wonderful movie called The American President, where the character played by Michael Douglas at the end of the movie talks about his opponent who says his opponent isn't trying to solve the problem. He's trying to make you fear something and trying to blame somebody else for the problem. And I think that is, it's amazing that our politicians are now doing exactly what Michael Douglas described in that movie. It's a shame.
Thanks, Christine, for the call. We go to Michael next in Milwaukee. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. I am enjoying the show and really enjoying the guest. I believe I am recalling correctly an earlier comment you've made about Steve Forbes and his platform, his consistent platform of lowering taxes to increase innovation and investment by corporations, and you said you agreed with that. That is just a similar argument to the current arguments that we hear all the time about job creators and lower taxes, and it appears to be your argument is that we need to moderate all that or else another bad thing will happen. But there is no empirical evidence that I'm aware of that shows that supply-side economics in that form of lowering taxes changes corporate investment and innovation. Now, obviously, things at the margin like R&D tax credits and other targeted investment programs do help, but they're all at the margin, and we have to assume that tax rates are not going to go up wildly to where they were 20 years ago, but it's all marginal. And there was a recent poll, I believe it was in the New York Times, published it in the past several weeks, asking a large number of corporate chieftains as to whether tax rates influence what they would do. And the answer was no. It would never influence what an entrepreneur does, what a chieftain would do. They do what they do to make money, and whether there is a higher or lower tax rate at the margin has no influence. So I believe that Steve Forbes argument is just another wolf in sheep's clothing, as we're hearing today in the area of job creators, and we need to lower taxes, lower taxes, lower taxes, because it'll all create jobs. There's, I am not aware of any empirical evidence out there that shows that.
Well, I'm going to politely disagree with Michael. Again, everybody has their own point of view on this. I, for one, do believe that free enterprise with reasonable tax rates and some regulation, but not huge amounts of regulation, I believe free enterprise produces the largest pie for the country. The problem is, today, our form of free enterprise is not doing a very good job of distributing or dividing that pie. And again, reasonable people will differ about this. I've thought about this and studied this and lived this for a long time. I'm not a big fan of Governor Perry in Texas. He talks about job creation. He didn't create jobs so much as steal them from other states. And he did that by making sure that when companies move from California to Texas, they would pay much lower taxes. So I do think that jobs and companies are attracted to lower tax environments. What I'm trying to say, Michael, and I don't expect everybody to agree, is that I do think free enterprise is generally a good thing. We need some regulation, for instance, in the area of credit derivatives, which created our financial crisis. We need regulation in areas where there are societal costs that aren't captured in the profit and loss statement of a company. For instance, when it comes to air and water pollution, because those costs don't hit the company, they hit the society, you need fiercer regulation. But I don't think that moving away from free enterprise or going to super high tax rates is the right way to go. And I'll give you what is my favorite example. And sorry for the length of this answer. I was born in 51 and began using a telephone maybe in 55. It was the first time I probably picked up the phone and spoke to a relative. And from 1955 to like 1975, our phone industry was entirely regulated. A single company rented you the phone you used. They controlled the lines that carried your voice. They controlled everything, and they controlled pricing. And over that 20-year period, the sum of the innovation that took place in that industry was you went from having a black phone to a choice of black or white or pink. And then, a couple years after that, it was a miracle of innovation. You had push-button phones instead of rotary dialing. So 20 years of innovation was really nothing. And I paid, I think, $10 on a Sunday night to talk to my parents when I was in college, who lived 100 miles away. Today, I have an iPhone. I've had one for 4 years. If you ask me, would AT&T, when it was regulated by our government, ever have produced an iPhone, I think it would have taken another 100 years. So free enterprise and deregulating that industry, I think, worked. Today, when I make a call, it doesn't cost me anything. Would all of this have happened in a regulated environment? I doubt it. So that's the good of free enterprise. Now I'll talk about the not so good. Where are those iPhones made? Well, unfortunately, most of the good middle-class jobs involved in making the parts that go into the iPhone, most of those good middle-class jobs are in Asia. They're not here in the U.S. There's a few engineers and some chip makers who are located in the U.S., but most of the jobs are overseas. And so I am very concerned that we're doing a lousy job with access to equal opportunity and with the distribution of the pie we're creating. But I have no doubt that free enterprise does create a larger pie. We're just doing a lousy job of sharing it.
Thanks, Michael, for the call. Jess in Madison is next. Hi, Jess.
Hi. Yeah, this is an interesting discussion, and I just wanted to first say I agree completely with the caller who just talked about there seems to be a total lack of understanding or even value of common good, public good. And as I told your screener, I was trying to think of what it means to be unselfish in our society, and I remember my grandfather, who was born in 1895, so he would have been one of the creators of the greatest generation as opposed to the greatest himself. But he was an executive in a company in New York City in the 1930s, early 30s. And when the Depression hit, the executives and the management all sat down and they all agreed that each one of them would take a substantial pay cut so that they would have to get rid of no employee, and they did not for the duration of the Depression. And I just can't even imagine that thought even going through anyone's mind today, unfortunately. But I just thought it was a real example of what it means not only to be unselfish, but not just expect everyone else to be unselfish. Anyway,
interesting story. Thank you. Thanks, Jess, for the call. Matthew.
Jess, can I let you know that there are leaders like that doing things like that today, and I'll talk about an example of one leader I know who does that. The gentleman who was the chief executive officer of Best Buy was named Brad Anderson. He retired about 2 years ago. And for the last 5 years that he ran Best Buy, he said, I don't want any stock options. I want you to take the stock options you would have given me, and these were worth millions of dollars, and I want you to divide them among our store employees. And he did that 5 years in a row, and he never wanted anybody to know that he did it. So it wasn't highly publicized, but there are leaders out there doing things like that.
Thanks very much for the call. We need to pause for a moment, and we'll return. We're speaking this hour with Matthew Paul. His piece is in The New Republic, Why Are the Children of the Greatest Generation So Selfish? Matthew was Senior Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of McDonald's Corporation until he retired from that position in January of 2008. He was a partner for some 18 years at Ernst & Young, managing a variety of financial practices. He has served as a board member of a number of organizations. Our number again, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, we go to Ken in Milwaukee. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I find this very interesting, and perhaps I'm misunderstanding what the guest is stances on taxes go, but as I understand, you're being a tax guy. I thought that I had heard that you're really not objecting to having a higher tax rate on higher tax earners. Perhaps I misunderstood that, but I'm also reminded of a prior guest, that Kathleen, that you had on a while ago, who had talked about what happened during right around World War II, when FDR called captains of industry and others into his office and said, we're going to raise taxes here because you are going to be paying for the war effort. And he was very direct in this. And that's what happened in order to win the war effort in World War II. I can't imagine that we're in any less dire straits right now. What's the holdup here?
Ken, I'll try to clarify my personal position. I think people who make a lot of money can afford to pay more in tax. I thought the tax rates during the Clinton era, which were, you know, 3 or 4 points higher, and that's the rate to which Obama wants to raise them, I think that's very reasonable. I have absolutely no problem with it. The issue that where we might differ is companies tend not to be patriotic. Companies move jobs to wherever taxes are lower. And if they're lower overseas, they will try to move more jobs there, and our tax law probably today makes that possible. So I think that individual taxes, I think the rich, you know, could be paying more in tax and should be paying more in tax given what we're going through today. If you try to raise taxes on companies, because that won't happen all around the world, companies will tend to move jobs to places where there are low taxes. Again, you can see it happening even within our country. Jobs move to lower tax states and tend to move out of higher tax states. A real good example is all of the job movement from California to Texas.
Well, don't they have, that goes back to where we started this conversation, actually, and I guess we disagree with each other on it. Was there a time, do you think, in America that we can all remember when corporations would also have the bottom line in mind, and also the responsibility but to stakeholders, but sacrifice perhaps some of their profits for the good of their community.
I think there was a time when companies could do that and could, quote-unquote, get away with it. I think it's harder today because of globalization. If a company wanted to do the right thing and keep more jobs here, 50 years ago, you could do that and not suffer competitively. But today, if, let's say, somebody who manufactures something wanted to keep more jobs here and pay $20 an hour here versus $1 an hour in China or $2 an hour in Mexico, their costs would be so much higher today than the competition that's using the cheaper labor that they would find themselves not in existence in a fairly short period of time. Once we made the decision to open our country to global competition, it was almost inevitable that this would happen. You know, people were warned that this would happen. It was very difficult to keep it from happening, and there are all kinds of benefits from free trade. They're just not distributed equally. So, you know, I don't shop at Walmart personally, but I do shop at Costco. Costco and Walmart get huge amounts of merchandise from countries with very inexpensive labor. As a result of that globalization effort, we can shop and buy things more affordably than if our markets were closed. But one of the prices of doing that is we're eroding our middle class, and very few companies are going to step up and say, I will do something about it. Now, the guy running Starbucks, Howard Schultz, has been very outspoken. He's said and done some things that are admirable, but most companies have a very heavy duty to their shareholders. And while they might want to do the patriotic thing, they might want to help the middle class, their primary focus is on producing the largest long-term bottom-line profit. Again, it may not be what your listeners would like to hear, but I think that's the way things work today.
Mm-hmm. Ken, thanks for the call. Here's an email from Bill, who graduated around 1990, he says, with an MBA from Madison. I quickly realized, to my chagrin, the nature of the education and its student was to take whatever, by whatever means, laws set a rather squishy floor, to enrich yourself and, incidentally, your firm. I realized the students would do almost anything to get ahead. I saw firsthand how they were going to eat my lunch on a daily basis if I continued in that career. I transitioned into the arts and still have a soul, poorer but contented.
I have friends who took that path, and I'm thrilled that they did, meaning going into the arts, saying, I'm not going to chase money. Life is about many more things than earning money, and I'm thrilled to hear that from Bill, and I wish that more people would move in that direction. My daughter, who's 20 years old and is in college, is studying history and the performing arts. She worked in a McDonald's store over the summer, and I'm thrilled that she's studying what she's studying. I was a liberal arts undergrad, and then I went into business and accounting at the graduate level, and I'm very happy that I did. I wish that more Americans could afford to study the arts before they have to think about their future career. Unfortunately, with college being as expensive as it is and jobs being as hard as they are to come by, very few can afford the luxury of studying the arts.
Ellen is next in Bayview. Hi, Ellen.
Hello there. How are you?
Fine. How are you, Ellen?
I'm good, Kathleen. I have 2 points, and first I want to go back to something at the beginning that you said you were so shocked and upset about, was the fact that these solar companies have gone out of business. I think our government, I know that somebody's going to say, oh, my God, but I think our government could be a little more progressive in that, in the way that, why aren't there solar panels on the White House? Why aren't there solar panels on the Pentagon? Why aren't there the government? Why isn't the government retrofitting all of its buildings? That seems to me that would be something. I know people say, "Oh, we're picking winners and losers," but you know, we really need to get rid of the oil. And secondly, I think that the captains of industry, you know, could no longer exploit the American population, so they are now exploiting other populations by giving them a few measly bucks to make the junk that they make.
Well, I'll try to respond to your question and comment, and it's a very interesting one. There clearly are things that the government has to do that no single private enterprise will ever do. I believe that solar energy is an example of that. But what happened recently is that government spending and stimulus and government investment in R&D was given a bad name. You know, President Obama launched what he called a stimulus program. You can't even use the word stimulus in a political discussion these days. It got tainted. And the reason it got tainted, and this is very unfortunate, one of his economists, I think it was Christine Romer, said if you pass the stimulus proposal, unemployment will never pass through the 8% threshold. We will keep it from passing through the 8% threshold. Now, nobody in his right mind ever should have made that kind of prediction. I personally believe that the stimulus program created a lot of jobs. It was the right thing to do. But nobody could have known how high unemployment might have grown without it. So predicting that this will keep unemployment below 8% was a dumb thing to do politically, and it has tainted all government spending and all attempts by President Obama to invest in R&D or additional stimulus. And it's very unfortunate because there are some things that the government absolutely has to do. But today, because of the taint associated with what was passed in 2009, it isn't going to happen. And it's very unfortunate.
Thank you, Ellen, very much for the call. Tom in Buffalo County, hi.
Ah, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I lived and worked for a German company from 1990 to 1993, and I was very impressed with the fact that they were so obsessed with conservation of oil and energy. And at the time, of course, their gasoline tax was 300%. It was about $4 per gallon over there versus $1.17 when I got back here, and I was like, why don't we just give it away? The point being is that if I've done some research, and per capita usage of oil in Germany is about one-half that of the United States. And as you know, they have the Autobahns. I frequently drove at 120 miles per hour, no problem. High-horsepower cars and very efficient cars were used as well. If we had the same per capita usage of oil in the United States, we could actually be an exporting oil nation. And I don't understand why there isn't like a public groundswell that would come up like with respect to tobacco usage and that would come up and say, we've got to reduce our energy usage and be more conservative and do all of these things. And why it isn't coming up from the bottom up to try to reduce the oil imports that we have in the U.S. And that's what I wanted to discuss.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for the call.
Tom, I'm with you 100%. It makes no sense that we're following the energy policies we're following. A lot of people say, I have the freedom to drive my car and use as much gas as I want. But if you look at the limited resources we have on this planet, and you look at what this is doing to our environment and to our security, there's almost no excuse for this. And had we done something back in the 90s, we wouldn't have been forced to support dictators in the Mideast for all these years, and our support of those dictators is part of the reason we have all the terrorist issues we have today, and we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars dealing with those issues. So it amazes me that we've not been able to deal with this situation. Part of it's because it's not a problem that hits you right in the face on any one day. It is a gradual problem. It is a long-term threat, but it is not a today threat. And our form of democracy isn't very good at gaining consensus on long-term threats.
Hmm.
On short-term threats like 9/11 or Hitler invading Europe, our form of democracy is pretty good at getting to the right consensus decision. But these longer-term threats, it's much harder for a politician in a 30-second soundbite to explain why we might need to implement a gas tax. Again, I agree with you 100%, Tom.
And Tom, in case you missed yesterday's show, you can get it online. We did a show on why the German economy is doing so well. It was a fascinating hour. So you may, because you spent time working there, listen. You may want to listen to that. It was at 9 o'clock? 9 o'clock tomorrow? Yesterday? Was it 9 o'clock, Chrissy? No, yesterday's German economy show. Was it 9 o'clock? It was 9 o'clock, so you can listen online. Well, Matthew, we come to the end of the hour, and I thank you very much for being with us. It was a provocative article, and it's always good to think. It's good to think.
Thanks to you and your listeners, Kathleen.
Matthew Paul, our guest. His piece is in The New Republic, and it is titled, Why Are the Children of the Greatest Generation So Selfish? Tomorrow at 9 o'clock, Jeremy Scahill, wonderful investigative reporter who's done great reporting from the Middle East. He's talking about Somalia. And Calvin Trillin, who has a 40-year collection of his very insightful and funny work in a book that's just been published. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour and for on-air production, and thanks for listening.